I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle's a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. On this podcast, we do something a little bit unique. We taste whiskeys, usually. We taste an alcoholic beverage because we love how that sets the table for great conversation. So, Kyle, we've got something special here tonight. What's happening?
Yeah, we do. So, if you have been listening to the show for a while, you might have heard a bonus episode that we did with our friends who run a YouTube channel called Power of Bourbon. And Tim, who is one of the hosts of that channel and also one of our Patreon supporters, has been a good friend ever since. And extremely graciously sent us a whole box of whiskey that we are so excited to taste. And so what we have done is we have so much of it, and we want to do all of it justice. And so we're going to do a series of tastings from this batch of things with Tim that he sent us. And so you're going to hear different of these in various episodes for a little while.
Yeah.
And we're going to taste them all blind. So we don't know what it is going into it. And so if you're wondering why Tim is showing up on the show a lot in the next few episodes, that's why.
Yeah, that means you finally get to hear somebody who knows what they're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. We're totally making it up, but Tim actually knows.
Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I don't know how much I know, but I know enough. We'll go with that.
Yeah. There's a scene in Parks and Rec where Ron Swanson walks into a Home Depot or something, and somebody just a hardware store, and somebody comes up and asks him if he needs help, and he's like, "I know more than you," and just keeps walking. That's you in a liquor store.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of memes about that with all of us bourbon guys.
Nice. All right. Well, let's do this.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of cherry on the nose.
It's a dark like caramel wood. Color.
It is. Yeah. Mm. It smells deep, rich, but it's got some sweetness to it in the nose, at least.
Mm.
Yep. Yeah, I get a old library smell to it.
Okay. Corn.
I'm going to guess it's a medium to high proof just based on the nose, but we'll see.
Ooh.
Mmm.
That's special.
It's unusual. Yep.
It's got the front of my palate gets nailed with sweetness right away. And then it rounds out to the back and edges of my palate with the oakiness, with the smoke, with some dark fruits. But that's complex. There's a lot going on in this bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming it's a bourbon.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Could be. Maybe not.
It doesn't taste like a rye to me,
Mm-mm.
so I'm going to say bourbon.
Mm-mm.
I think it's definitely a bourbon.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's barrel proof.
I take back what I said about the proof. It was not as strong as I expected.
Yeah, so this bottle, the reason I chose it is it's special, and when you try it, you get that specialness in the tasting. So
it's hard to put a word on what it is that makes it different. I mean, it's
I'm glad that you're struggling, because maybe I just haven't had enough nice stuff to be able to identify. It's just so complex.
It hits me at first. This is going to sound so sacrilege, Tim, so I'm sorry for saying this, but I've got a friend who makes whiskey, and he makes really good whiskey. But it tastes, at first, it hits me with a little new-makey sweetness of it, because the sweetness is kind of raw, almost. But then it fills in with the complexity, and you know you're not drinking something that's new-makey, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think there's a fair amount of age on it, just because of how strong the wood is. It's almost like a tree bark level, but not in a bad way, and a little bit of char.
It's one of those that it fills your whole mouth.
It does.
So it's not going to just go straight down the center or anything like that. It gets all the way into the jawline and just really just hangs on and gives you a nice finish. It's
still tingling.
Yeah, it gives you the tingly cheek kind of thing. Yes. Yeah, for sure. All right, can you tell us?
So this is I.W. Harper from 1980.
Whoa.
So that is when it was bottled. So this is what we call a dusty. So a dusty. For my birthday, I got to go to a vintage liquor store and get some stuff. So this was distilled in the 70s, bottled in the 80s, and it is just a regular I.W. Harper bottled in bond.
Now, that's incredible. So when it's in the bottle, it's been in the bottle for 40 years or something like that. It's done with all the changing and it's done with the flavor. It doesn't do anything to sit in the bottle for 40 years, does it?
As long as you keep it out of the sunlight and around 75-ish degrees, you know, plus or minus a couple, it won't change at all. And that also depends on like a good seal so that it doesn't oxidize or anything like that. So when I was there, like we checked the seal and everything like that to make sure all that stuff was good.
So none of the kind of oddness of the flavor profile you think comes from the fact that it's a dusty, as you said? Like, that's got to play into it somewhat, right?
Yeah, so that little, like, when you said it's got a little funk or something that you haven't tasted before, that's kind of the dusty note that you get. Yeah. And also, we've changed, like, with the types of corn we've used, distillation method, everything like that. The environment's changed, and that affects bourbon in so many ways. So there's a lot of people and purists that are like, everything before this time is way better than everything after this time.
This is what it tasted like before global warming.
Yeah. I love it.
There you go.
Yeah.
So how old was it when it was bottled?
So it's bottled and bond, so at least 4 years.
Okay, but no age statement. Was it common to have age statements back then?
No.
Interesting.
I mean, you had the, like, you know, straight, which is over 2 years, bottled and bond, which is four. But that was the original reason they did bottled and bond back in the day, is because you had rectifiers and people like that, that what they would do is they would put additives in it. And so the reason bottled and bond came around was to protect it, so you knew this was authentic, pure bourbon that was not tainted in any way.
Yeah.
Wow.
So when you had said to us before, some of these things I sent you, I'll never see again, I'm understanding why.
Yeah. Yeah. So before this tasting gets, you know, turns into an episode, Tim, can you tell us one more time what we're drinking?
We are drinking I.W. Harper Bottled and Bond from the 1980s.
Cheers to Tim.
Thanks for sharing that.
Dr. Grace Jisun Kim, thank you so much for joining us on A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm so excited to speak with you tonight. So thank you so much.
Absolutely, Dr. Kim. When we were off air, you just said you broke your knee in Israel-Palestine 2 days before the fighting broke out. How are you?
Oh, I am still in a lot of pain. I've actually hurt the same knee that I hurt 15 years ago, but that time it wasn't broken. It was a ripped meniscus, but I had surgery on it. And then this time around, I was there and I fell on a pile of rocks inside a hotel. So still in a lot of pain, but grateful to be home. Came home 2 days before the airstrike. So it's wonderful to be home.
Oof, yeah. When I reached out to you, you have a number of books. How many books have you written, Dr. Kim?
I think 22 now.
Yeah.
No, so exciting.
Yeah. And you wanted to talk about your book, Invisible, from 2021. Now, usually we, you know, in our interviews, we gear our conversations around a book. It's really convenient for a quality interview. And this book, Invisible, it's about the most autobiographical book and the most personal book that we've read on the podcast, I would say. It's extremely personal, goes back into your roots, your ancestors, your culture in some profound ways, in some really deeply personal ways. So usually I start out by asking, where did this book come from? But can you just tell us about yourself a little bit, your background, and yes, where this book came from, Dr. Kim?
You know, I was born in Korea, and then our family immigrated in 1975 to Canada. So I write some stuff about growing up in Canada in the book. And we immigrated, well, then myself and my own now nuclear family, we moved to the U.S. in 2004 to begin teaching here in the U.S. So my life is kind of separated into three parts. And as an immigrant child, I've experienced so much racism, and I think the common experience for many Asian Americans is this notion of being invisible. So I thought for a long time, I've kind of wanted to write this book, and the timing was right, and I just kind of wrote it. But I didn't realize how autobiographical it was until I was in the copy editing stage. And after I had submitted my manuscript to the publisher, I got really ill. So I was hospitalized. And then I didn't look at it for months. when the copy editing came, I realized I included all these personal stories. And I was a little bit in shock because I had forgotten I put them all in. And I was debating, should I start deleting some of them? And I realized if I start deleting, I'm going to start deleting all the stories, which will mean that there'll be nothing left of the book. And for me, as an Asian American theologian and as a feminist theologian, we do so much of our theology from our own experiences. So at the end of the day, I accepted and I kept all the stories, and they're all in the book. So for listeners, if you're curious about more details about my life, you can go and read this book. It's quite interesting when you said this was the most autobiographical book that you had on your podcast. My next book, well, my next book that's coming out is called When God Became White. Mm-hmm. And I felt I put so much of my other stories in there. I guess I have a ton of stories about my life, but I put a lot of my other personal stories in there too.
Good grief. When God Became White, when can we expect that?
That'll be coming out in May 7th, 2024, and that's with InterVarsity Press. And it will line up with AAPI Heritage Month. So it'll be exciting that we can celebrate AAPIs here in America. And it'll be a few days after my birthday. So it's going to be an exciting May 2024.
Yeesh. Well, can we book you right away for May and to interview about How God Became White? That's incredible. So this book that we're talking about today is Invisible, Theology and the Experience of Asian American Women. Early on in the book, Grace, you paint this picture of Asian American women being doubly marginalized, both out in the world in North America, whether in Canada or in America, and at home. Can you tell our listeners about that reality and bring us into that world of being doubly marginalized as an Asian American woman?
So many of us, just Asian Americans as a whole, we feel, the concept of being invisible is one. Another part of our identity is being marginalized. So we are never going to be part of the white dominant society or culture because we are just visibly, we look different. You and I, you're white, I'm Asian. So our features are different. If our kids never intermarry, we're going to have this visible identity. So in many ways, we have become marginalized in society. We are the foreigner. We are the subordinated, the oppressed kind of group. So our identity as marginalized people is really central to our identity as much as our experience of being invisible. So when you add in the layer of being an Asian American woman, within the Asian culture, with the Asian North American culture, it is still very patriarchal. With Confucianism and just as a whole, many parts of Asia are very patriarchal. So as an Asian American woman, when we come back into our homes, when I was growing up, it was very clear who the head of the household was. My father told us many times that he's the head of the household and we all had to listen to him and obey him. So in that way, many Asian American women are doubly marginalized, once in society and then once within the household or within the Asian American culture itself, whether you go to church or in the Asian American community, it's very clear that it's still very patriarchal and that women are subordinate to men.
Mm-hmm. In ways, I want to bring out as many stories from the book as possible. Listeners, you should read this book. This is one of those books that I think is a must read. It's really, really important and opened my eyes to a whole world that I had no idea existed. To be honest with you, I feel terrible saying that, honestly, Dr. Kim, but it's a reality. One of those little snapshots is when you talked about what you called your tiger uncle, and how he basically just watched him boss around your mom, even though she was a woman. But tell us about that tiger uncle and just how that kind of is a microcosm of the patriarchy within, whether it's Asian American families or.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for saying all those nice things about my book. I'm really excited about the book, and I hope more and more people will read it, because there's not that much interest in Asian American kind of literature or people as a whole. So I'm just thrilled when people want to read it. And the readers will get a sense of, or they'll learn a lot about Asian Americans and Asian American women, but I've always written it so that it'll be a lens for them to understand how other groups are made invisible or marginalized or oppressed. So I'm hoping that readers who get the book, your listeners, will get a deeper understanding of Asian American culture and theology and understanding, but also it will help them see how other groups of people are marginalized. So going back to how I wrote about my uncle, who we called Uncle Tiger, or in Korean, we said, so that's the Korean term that we had. So my mother, there was four daughters and then four brothers, and she was the youngest. Out of eight, she was the sixth child, and below her were two younger sisters. So this Uncle Tiger, he was very, very scary. That's why every one of us, all the cousins, there must have been 35 or over 40 cousins, we all labeled him Uncle Tiger, because he was this authoritative man in the household. And when cousins met him, or when his siblings, when we had family get-togethers, it was very clear that he was going to boss his sisters, whether they were older than him or younger than him. So my mother was younger than him, but I remember clearly how he kind of bossed her around. She was a grown woman married with children, and it was very clear that he still wanted to tell her what to do, boss her around, and just make all of us all kind of scared of him. And my mother was scared of him too, because he was this authoritarian figure in her household. And that's very common in many households. It's usually the father of the household or the grandfather. But in mine, on my mother's side, we had this very scary uncle. But you see this in many, many households and many families in Korea and in immigrant households.
So you speak of how Asian Americans are perceived in America in particular, and how they're kind of relegated to these types, or little boxes. And you talk about how Asian American men are often emasculated within American culture, and how Asian American women are often kind of trivialized into pictures of submissive, hypersexualized, exotic beings. Can you speak to what that does for Asian American sense of self and identity in America?
Thank you for that question. So why women are portrayed that way? When Asians started coming, a lot of Asians came about 150 years ago to either work on the railroad, so, building the railroad, or they came because of this gold rush in San Francisco. So that's how many came. And then in Hawaii, many Japanese and Koreans went to work in the sugarcane farm and other farming within Hawaii. So many people that came were actually men. So Asian men kind of came to the U.S. They thought, okay, they'll make some money and then they'll go back home. They realized that it was very difficult to make money. They just assumed that when you came to U.S., you'll make a lot of money. But they barely survived with the little measly income that they were given, either working on the railroad or digging for gold. On the railroad, there were other white people who worked. The white people were paid much more than the Asian workers, and they were also given free food. Asian workers had to pay for their food from the measly paycheck that they got. And also the dangerous work, blowing up mountains, using dynamite, the Asian workers were told to do that. So you already see this discrepancy and how racism comes into play, where many Chinese workers on the railroad died building it across the U.S. So many workers were men. And then the few women that were allowed to come in were then forced into becoming sex workers. And so right from the beginning, the portrayal of Asian women were that they were these sex workers, they're here to please white men. So that was kind of the stereotype that was given to Asian women. And it has stayed on with us. That's how when you watch movies, you know, the opera, Madame Butterfly, or I guess the movie is... Miss Saigon, the portrayal is this fragile woman. You know, Madame Butterfly, the butterfly is so fragile. So Asian women are portrayed like that. And also as sexual pleasers for white men. And Miss Saigon, you have this white soldier from the U.S. coming into Vietnam and using this woman. And this woman falls in love, but he doesn't disclose that he is already married or to be married to a white woman. So, you know, that's a typical narrative that was portrayed for Asian women, and it has stayed on with us. For the Asian men, they were always portrayed as inferior, not strong, kind of feminine. And you see this in
Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Yeah, that movie and other movies where you're portraying Asian men as a clown, as someone who isn't this kind of masculine identity, very feminized. And that continues on today. And part of that is because we don't want other men to kind of dominate or make white men look bad or make them afraid of the other people. So if you kind of feminize Asian men, then they are inferior to white men. They cannot kind of come and kind of scare them off or threaten them because they are portrayed as this feminized masculine identity. And that continues on today too in social media, in movies and other portrayals.
Yeah. I'm just interested at what that kind of objectification does to a person's identity and sense of self.
It puts us down in so many ways as women, because this objectification prevents society from viewing particularly someone like me as, oh, she can be educated and be a professor or be an ordained minister or be a scientist or a mathematician, all those things, because of we have been objectified. We are viewed as sex workers. And this portrayal, you know, I write about the comfort woman in the book too. So that was a huge atrocity that was done towards Korean, really young girls by the Japanese. But it's this continual portrayal of Asian women as sex workers, to be dominated, to be abused, and it's still all okay. Mm-hmm. Comfort Woman was happening during the war, where Japanese kidnapped young girls, like 10-year-olds, 9-year-olds, and maybe older teens. The older teens were taken under the pretense that they're going to be working in factories. So many, many girls were taken and they were used as sexual slaves for the Japanese soldiers. And when we think, oh, okay, so sexual slaves, okay, they worked at night. This is they worked in the daytime and they served, you know, many of these women have kind of written about it and told the public. Many committed suicide. Many were murdered. But the few surviving, now there's only a handful of them in their 80s and 90s right now. But they said they served from 40 to like 70 men a day. So what that would do to a woman's body, or it breaks your body apart. And that's why when many of them had diseases, they were murdered because they didn't want to deal with the women who were sick. So things like this, and when the American soldiers, you know, they're still there in Korea, they set up these kind of little towns or townships. I don't know how you call them in English, but they were places where the white American soldiers can go to buy sexual workers. And many of these women were murdered. It's illegal for Koreans to have prostitutes, but they were designated. The government allowed this to happen in these designated kind of towns or these areas for the white American soldiers because, you know, it satisfied them and it brought in American dollars into Korea. So these things happened at a huge cost to Korean women. And so, you know, that's happening in Asia, but then you see this also happening here where they are objectified and it has happened from the beginning of immigration and it continues to happen today.
Yeah, the story that you told, was the woman related to you whose story you told? Who's the comfort woman?
No.
It was shocking. I, you know, stopped and had to talk to my wife and was horrified by the story. It's that part alone is worth purchasing and reading this book, Invisible. As you make a case for the invisibility of Asian American women in the book, you really give us a history lesson on Asian immigration and Asian American history. Can you just bring our listeners a little bit, without giving away the whole thing, into the systemic racism and oppression that Asian Americans have had to live in historically and presently in America?
So I think because I grew up in Canada, when we talked about racism, it was just anyone who was non-white experienced racism. So Asian Americans, Asian Canadians, the Aboriginals, the African Canadians, and the Latinx community. But here in the U.S., after I came in 2004, overnight I realized that racism is talked about in black and white terms. So if it's talked about in black and white terms, anyone that falls in between, our experiences of racism are often ignored, or white culture, white society will say to us, oh, that isn't racism because you're not black. So even within the discourse of racism, we experience it, because our bodies are different, our ethnicity is different, we experience it continually. But when we share that these are experiences of racism, white dominant culture, many times they will say that's not racism. And that part itself contributes to the invisibility of Asian Americans because our experiences are often ignored or neglected or just said that isn't racism. But we experience it all the time, and there's many different ways of experiencing racism. You know, I talk about xenophobia in the book. Xenophobia comes from the Greek word, you know, xeno meaning foreigner, phobia meaning, you know, afraid. So we have lots of phobias here in the U.S., but xenophobia is being afraid of the foreigner. And Asian Americans, even though we could have been here for over 100 years, 200 years, we are still considered foreigners for some various aspects. When African Americans, they've been here a while too, for many generations, and many of them have been here from the time of enslavement, they're not often called foreigners. They are just referred as African Americans. And I think the same would be with the Latinx community and the Native Americans. But for some reason, Asian Americans are continuously viewed as foreigners. So we are often labeled as perpetual foreigners. So even though we've been here a couple hundred years, we will still be viewed as foreigners. And often people ask the question, where are you from? That may be asked to an African American, Latinx, or Native American, but many times it's asked as, oh, what city are you from? But for many, many Asians, the underlying notion behind that question is, oh, are you from Korea, China, Japan, Malaysia? That's what they really want to hear. They don't really want to hear, oh, I'm from Pennsylvania or from New York. Once I respond that way, as an Asian American, they'll ask you, no, where are you really from? And that continues the perpetuation that we are these foreigners. We can never be an American, we're always Asian American, but we can never be a full American. While as someone from Ukraine or from Portugal or somewhere from, you know, Western Europe can come, and they may not be able to speak English because, you know, they may speak French like many people in France do. We just think all of Europe speaks English, but they don't. There's Portuguese and Spanish and French and Ukrainian. But they can come to the U.S. maybe last month, and no one will view them as a foreigner, because if you're white and light-skinned and you're from Western Europe, you're just automatically, oh, you just have a beautiful accent. Oh, I love your British accent. Oh, I love your Parisian accent. It's so beautiful. While as someone from Asia, you know, who have lived here for a while but still has this kind of accent, nobody likes an Asian accent. Everybody loves a European accent, but they don't. And they will continue to say, oh, you are a foreigner, even though you may have been born here or have been here as an immigrant for 20 years. So this perpetual foreigner, xenophobia. So if you're a foreigner, white dominant society will continue to be afraid of us. And you saw this during the COVID pandemic. You know, we had Trump saying, oh, what did he call it? The Chinese flu, or
the China virus, I believe.
The China virus. And he had all these other crazy names for it. But he blamed, and oftentimes Asian Americans are blamed for when something goes wrong because they're afraid of us. They think we're bringing the disease. And this COVID isn't the first time. There were other pandemics in the early 19th century, and et cetera, and they often blame the Chinese. So you saw a lot of attacks against Chinese immigrants when a disease started happening. And then they said, of course, it's the Asians that brought it. So there's often a blame. This is the xenophobia. So there were all these different aspects, you know, the stereotyping, the prejudice against Asian Americans. These are all the experiences of racism that we experience on a daily basis. You know, we are blamed for a lot of different things. And, you know, part of my task is to fight against this racism that persists here in America and beyond.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC, and if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's StoryhillBKC.com.
You're leading right into my next question, Dr. Kim. I'm the son of an immigrant. My mom emigrated to the United States from Finland in 1968 when she was 19 years old. And she still has an accent to this day. One of a clear memory in high school was a girl calling my house, a girl who I liked. I answered the phone and said hello. After my mom gave me the phone, she answered the phone. And her first thing that she said to me was, Randy, I didn't know that you had a maid. And I was so confused. I was like, what is she talking about? And then I was like, oh, you think my mom's are made because she has an accent? No, that's my mom, you know. So as you were talking about this experience of watching your mom, you know, have trouble interacting in English and being immediately treated in a condescending way and in an inferior way, I know exactly what you're talking about after seeing that dynamic with my mom, where she's struggling to ordering at a restaurant is an embarrassing thing for my mom. You know, the difference about me being son of an immigrant is that I'm white, I'm European. So you'd never know that I'm the son of an immigrant, and you'd never associate me in those terms. We like to think in America, we have this romanticized version of we're a nation of migrants and of immigrants. But not all immigration and immigrant stories are the same, right? Like we European Americans like to talk about how Ellis Island, everybody came in and it was great, and maybe we should go back to that. But that's not the same reality in the history of Asian American immigration. Can you bring us into the different story that Asian American immigrants have than maybe European immigrants?
When the immigration happened, Europeans, you know, they got on the boat and they came through Ellis Island. And when they came, some people didn't have papers. Many of them were, fleeing the potato famine or some other famine. Many of them were weak. They weren't healthy, but they were processed immediately. There was nothing wrong. The people that worked in the immigration, they never held them back. So that is a stark difference from what happened to Asians that came through Angel Island in San Francisco. So many boarded the ships and they came to Angel Island. And many Asians that were coming were mostly the strongest because you had to go in your own country, kind of go through a rigorous physical exam, etc. So they only sent the best people, the well-educated and the physically strong people. Many of them had the paperwork when they left their own country. But in Ellis Island, they were treated like prisoners. They weren't processed quickly.
In Angel Island, you mean?
In Angel Island, yeah. In Angel Island in San Francisco, so on the West Coast versus the East Coast where the Europeans were coming in Ellis Island, when Asians were coming in through Angel Island, it was like a prison. Many of them were locked up for weeks, some for months, and some for years for no reason. You know, the authorities that were working there just didn't feel like letting them through. They were suspicious of Asian workers that were coming, even though they were the healthiest one and the most strongest ones. Versus in the Europe, you know, in Ireland and other places where they were, you know, fleeing the potato famine or other forms of famine or economic loss. They weren't always the strongest people, but there was no question. They were allowed in. So you see this right from the beginning, the difference in how immigrants are processed. We're all immigrants that are coming into this country. The only native people to this land are the Native Americans. Everyone else is an immigrant one way or another, or brought here forcefully as enslaved Africans or other means. They were brought here, but the only people are the Native Americans. But I think Americans, somehow we have a short memory or amnesia or something. We just don't remember our history. But I think it's really, really important to study our history. I raised 3 kids here in the U.S. from kindergarten, all of them, and none of them learned anything about Asian history, Asian American history. They might have learned a little bit about Black enslavement during Black History Month, but we don't teach it. And a few years ago, we held protests in New York because New York has a large percentage of Asian immigrant population, and we want Asian immigrant history and stories to be taught in the public schools, just as we learn other immigration stories. I don't think they've actually put them in, but we continue to protest that because it's not part of our curriculum. So, you know, you don't know it, but you're not the only one. It's never taught. And in your adulthood, there's so many other things to learn and read. So Asian American history may be the last thing. So I'm so grateful for you to invite me on your podcast to talk about it and share. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say, Dr. Kim, that I don't know Asian American history. I don't know the stories of the immigrants and all that. Even if, as you were talking about Chinese men building the railroads and, you know, blasting through mountains to make these happen, I remember in history class seeing pictures of that happening. And the thing is that everyone in those pictures was white. I didn't see any, you know, Chinese or Asian men doing the work, because if I'm not mistaken, they never took any pictures of them. They wanted to hide them. Is that right?
Yeah. And then there are a few, you can find them online. But the fact that when we teach our history, we want to make them invisible. Mm-hmm. So this is the whole problem. Asian Americans are made invisible right from the beginning. The pictures of white men building the railroad was a very big narrative, but many Chinese were building that railroad and many, many people died building it. Mm-hmm. So, but it's another part of the history. You want to make us invisible, or white society in general wants to make us invisible.
Yes. This idea of invisibility is really kind of echoes in your book when you get into the autobiographical stuff, and you tell us in the book about what it was like to be a Korean Canadian little girl in Toronto and what it felt like to be in school and the depression, the disorientation, the silence, the invisibility in many ways. Can you tell us, I think in America, we have this romanticized vision of immigration and, you know, everyone's coming to have this better life and it's going to be as soon as you cross the border, it's going to be perfect life. Can you tell us about your experience in real life of what it was like to be a little girl growing up in schools as a Korean Canadian girl?
I can say it was very difficult. You know, as a young girl, I started kindergarten. I didn't know a word of English. We never took English classes in Korea. You know, I just knew that we were immigrating. But as a five-year-old, you don't have any concept of what immigration means and the impact it will have. All I knew was I was going to board a flight and I was going to land in some different country. So starting kindergarten, when it's supposed to be fun and games, it's like the best time of your life before all the hard homework that you get. It was a difficult time. You know, that was so long ago, but it's incredible how you remember certain things. And I remember being teased all the time. Even though I didn't know the language, I was teased and I knew because people are laughing at you, making fun of your features. You know, they did the pull eye, you know, and crisscrossing and, you know, they did all that. And I still remember, and it wasn't just in kindergarten. It began in kindergarten, but it continued on. And it was this daily thing I had to fight. And I think I just internalized that, you know, I have to be better. So I really, really studied hard. I just wanted to be the top of the class. But even if you are the top of the class, I graduated top of the class, there is still racism because people just don't like you. Not because of your character, but because you just look different. And I grew up in a really small town, London, Ontario. It was called WASP. I don't know if we use that term anymore, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant community. So, you know, a few immigrants coming from Korea to this predominantly white society, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant society, it was hard. So I remember just, you know, going to the grocery store with my mother and people just making fun of us. They don't know who we are, but there's no need to make fun of us, but they do. So this continual racist actions towards us is a very painful thing. And it's still part of your memory. And, you know, it still happens today. People make fun of, you know, my mother passed away, but my father's still alive. Because people know that they can get away with it. They know that Asian Americans aren't going to really fight, you know, physically or do something kind of. So people know that they can get away with it. So people will continue to make fun, mock us if they can. People still don't want to hear about Asian American theology. They don't want to learn from an Asian American theologian, let alone an Asian American woman. So there's a lot of battles that I still fight. So I'm always thankful for people like you who are interested and want to share about some of our struggles to learn and to get a deeper understanding of theology and of who God is.
I can't wait to get into that portion of the interview. It's coming soon, I promise. We won't go too long. But in chapter three, the chapter on racism, you say you were hinting at xenophobia a little bit, but this statement you said, the sentence that you wrote, just smacked me upside the face. You said, xenophobia is a defining feature of American life. Xenophobia is a defining feature of American life. I want listeners to sit with that. Can you define, you did it before, but can you again define xenophobia for us and explain your statement that xenophobia is a defining feature of American life?
I think, you know, xenophobia, afraid of the foreigner. Mm-hmm. We are always afraid of the foreigner. So I've talked about Asian Americans being the perpetual foreigner. Doesn't matter how many generations. But then when we have migrants coming from the South, from the Mexican border, from Central America, South America, we get afraid of these so-called foreigners. We don't want to let them in because we are afraid that they're going to take all our jobs. So the xenophobia is so embedded in this American culture. But when we think about the migrant workers who come, they're all the jobs that none of us want. You know, nobody wants to pick tomatoes all day long in the hot sun or pick lettuce or these hard labor. None of us have dreams of, oh, we're going to raise our kids to be cleaning toilets all day long. Yeah. We don't want those jobs, but we still have this narrative, oh my goodness, they're coming to steal all our jobs. Yeah. So the xenophobia is this defining nature of this American culture. You know, we have refugees coming. And I think as a wealthy nation, we should be accepting refugees, whether they're political refugees, climate refugees, or socioeconomic refugees, but we're so afraid of them mm-hmm. that they're going to bring some disease. So I think this American culture, we really need to understand how we are acting and reacting. You know, as Christians, you know, when we study the Bible, Jesus welcomed the marginalized, the oppressed, those who were on the outskirts. He talked to the Samaritan woman. You know, Jews and Samaritans weren't supposed to interact. And even in the Old Testament, it's, you know, there's all these verses and stories of the foreigner and how you are to welcome the foreigner and be with the foreigner. And the foreign woman are also in the biblical passages. And God uses the foreign woman. And so when we look at the lineage of Jesus, the lineage is from a foreign woman. So God uses foreigners to somehow teach us different lessons. And I think if we kind of open our eyes and see what is happening, how we are behaving and how our culture is reacting to foreigners, I think we should kind of sit back and kind of examine our own lives. And are we welcoming the foreigner as God had told us to do? I can't remember the passage right now, but you may remember the passage better than me, of welcoming the foreigner into your land because you were once foreigners yourself. I think that is such an important passage for us, especially America, a land of immigrants, a land of foreigners who have come, but somehow the white European immigrants have become the settlers, have come to colonize here the North American land, have become afraid of other foreigners that are coming into the land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're making me want to preach a sermon, Dr. Kim, and I'm not going to do that. So you did very, very well.
I may start preaching if you keep asking me these questions.
I know it. You're doing it. I love it. Let's talk about church stuff a little bit. You speak of the Korean church as both a place of refuge and safety, relationship, family, all the things that you need and just have to have and crave as an immigrant, but also a place of marginalization and oppression for Korean American women. Can you explain that reality for us?
Yeah, so it goes back to one of the first questions that you asked about the doubly oppressed. So, but you know, when I think about Asian Americans in the church, it's not much different from other women too, because churches are male spaces. Traditionally, you know, the theologians, all the major theologians are men for the last 2,000 years. They have created these doctrines, created God as a white male God. So we are entering these spaces, these male spaces. So it is difficult for many women, and particularly Korean women back in Korea, and also Korean immigrant women, Korean American women here. So in a way, the churches are kind of these hubs for many immigrants, because if you don't speak the English language and you crave your Korean identity, your culture, and white society isn't a safe place for many immigrants, especially the first generation immigrants, then the church is a place of refuge to provide all of this. When my parents first immigrated, the church was a place to find employment, because it was by word of mouth. You asked one another, where can I work? Where can I find a job? Or how can I start a business? It was a place where immigrants all shared those information. And many of the Korean churches still today hold language, Korean language school, either a Friday night or a Saturday or a Sunday, where adults or many children can go to learn the Korean language and Korean culture. So it was this wonderful place, and still continues to be a wonderful place, where it's not just a place of worship, but a place to socialize and learn and share and eat Korean food together. So it's a wonderful place. But then, because of patriarchy and Confucianism is also very embedded within the Korean churches, and Confucianism, their motto is obedience. So, you know, women are to obey. So women are to obey three people: their father when they're young, their husband when they're married, and then when they become widowed, they obey their sons. So it's this complete obedience to men. And then, of course, in the Korean American churches, majority, I can't think of a Korean American church where the senior pastor is a woman, let alone any pastor is a woman. So you are to be obedient to the male minister, as you would your father or your husband or your son. So it is this complete kind of obedience. You kind of listen and you obey whatever the Korean male pastor is saying. So in that kind of culture and society and the church, yes, women are then doubly marginalized and oppressed and forced to obey.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult for Korean American women.
Yeah, it's as if Korean American women are almost triply marginalized, because it's in the world, the American world, it's in at home, and then it's at church as well.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Kim, let's finish our time by talking a little bit theology. Really fun stuff. In chapter 4, you speak to the reality that we in the white American church have created a white male God who blesses our xenophobia, patriarchy, and racism. You said, and I'm quoting you now, "The maleness and whiteness of the Christian God needs to be dismantled if racism and sexism are to be eliminated." I'm going to say that again just so everyone that registers. You said, "The maleness and whiteness of the Christian God need to be dismantled if racism and sexism are to be eliminated." Such a strong statement, such an essential statement for us to hear. Most of us say racism and sexism should be eliminated, but you say if that's going to happen, the maleness and whiteness of the Christian God need to be dismantled in order for racism and sexism to be eliminated. Can you expound on that? Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll explain it. But then I actually wrote a lot more about it in the next book, When God Became White. It was originally called, I submitted it as Whiteness, because so much of this problem is rooted in whiteness. But anyway, I'll come back to your podcast maybe and talk about that one. But then they changed it to When God Became White because it's so interrelated. So when I do, you know, when I teach theology, so many people think, oh, theology is not that important, or religious studies. You know, when college is the first thing to go, if there's no money left in the budget, is the religion department and the philosophy department, which are usually maybe combined in small colleges.
My co-host would have something to say about that, about philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, because we think, oh, it's not that important. But religion really, and theology, really impacts how we see the world and view the world. So much so, it really determines our ethics, what we do every day, how we treat one another, how we come up with these laws. You know, we have, you know, right now about abortion laws, immigration laws. Are we going to go into war? You know, are we going to engage in war? All these things are determined by our own religious understanding and our theological understanding. It doesn't matter what religion, it always has an impact. So we as Christians, how we understand who God is, even though the Bible is so clear that we are to love God and to love one another, somehow we just create our own little laws. You know, I've heard so many sermons and I've preached on this so many times, but in our own little minds, we say, okay, we can love who we want to love. You know, so whether, if they're an immigrant, forget it, because, you know, maybe they brought a disease, or maybe they're going to preach or teach me weird things, or my kids. All these things are affecting, you know, theology and religion has so much effect on us. So if we continue to talk about a white male God, it will continue to perpetuate white supremacy, white privilege, and it will continue to institute racism and patriarchy and sexism in the church and in society. Because in the Bible, it never really says God is white. I've never seen any passage that God is white. Mm-hmm. But we Christians continue to claim that God is white, whether in our theological mind or how we portray God in our writing. And then, well, the other default is how we portray Jesus as white. He was never white. He was a Palestinian Jew, probably very, very dark, probably black hair. In another podcast, I mentioned that, you know, he was dirty, so he must have smelled. And then the host got all like, what? He got all surprised. But my point is, he is not who we have portrayed him to be for the last 2,000 years. He's not this emperor wearing this beautiful robe, white skinned, you know, pearly white skin, with blonde, clean hair, with blue eyes, and perfect beard. He was this straggly, kind of homeless man. You know, because he roamed, he didn't really have a house when he was doing ministry. He just went from one place to another. And I am most certain that he was dirty and smelly, even though another podcast host was really shocked by my statement. But I just got back from Palestine and Israel. And today, 2,000 years later, you know, better hygiene, better roads, better everything. But there's a lot of dirt roads still. So it's really dusty. I remember I took my daughter and I said, after the day, we're just going to put all our clothes, what we wore, in another separate bag. Because I said, it's really dusty, you know, today. But I can't imagine how dusty it was back then. It was all dirt roads, people. And that's why, you know, in the Bible, it talks about all these cleansing rituals when you go to a person's house, you know, with the water and cleaning your feet and hands. In Korea, if you enter a person's house, or many of the homes are built where the bathroom is right by the entrance, whether it be an apartment building or traditional homes, it's because, you know, if it's dirty, you go in there and wash your feet and hands before you enter the house. Today, we still don't wear shoes in the home. So, you know, we want everything clean that comes into the house. But anyway, my point is, we've made him white in the image of these white emperors that ruled the land, the Roman Empire, the Greco-Roman Empire. And after that, you know, the white European theologians, the medieval theologians, the Reformation theologians, all white. So God continues. So by default, Jesus being portrayed white, God is portrayed white and male. There are enough references in the Bible of God not being a man or a male, but we have continued to portray him. And all of this is to say that if we don't dismantle this, it will continue to perpetuate racism, xenophobia, patriarchy, all these isms that we should not have in society or in our church. It will just continue to have it. And I think as church leaders, as ministers, it is part of our task to dismantle racism and sexism. But if we continue to worship a white male God, it'd be very difficult to dismantle it, because that white male God continues to tell us that there's a hierarchy of people.
Yes.
There's a hierarchy of gender, and men are at the top, and a hierarchy of people, and white people are at the top.
Yes.
Because God is the white male God.
Yes. It's why theologians...
It's overlapping with my new book coming out. But anyway, thank you for asking that question. Yes. I think it's an important one, and maybe your listeners may not appreciate it, but I think it's an important question.
I think they will appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, the idea that our racism, our xenophobia, our sexism, and patriarchal culture is rooted in our vision of God is such a sobering and staggering statement and thing to consider and hold. And I think it's absolutely true. You also say, this is just I love the provocative things that you bring in your book. You say that Christianity in America follows the religion that should be called Americanity rather than Christianity. Just briefly, can you say what's behind that statement?
Yeah, I think I was with Reverend Jackson and he kind of used the term Americanity, and I think I've adopted it. I can't remember if I said it first or he said it first.
We're going to say you said it first.
Definitely. Okay. I think it's because of this Christian nationalism, and just in America, we've created this Christianity. Like, I've gone to so many churches where there's an American flag.
Yes.
Near the pulpit. I don't know why there's an American flag. What is the purpose of the American flag, or outside the church, or somewhere in the church building? I don't understand this. It has nothing to do with Christianity, so I don't know why it's there. If you're going to put a cross, yes, that is symbolic, and you know, we recognize that Christ died on the cross. So yes, I see why there is a cross, or why there's a burning bush, a picture of a burning bush, or a stained glass window of Moses, or things like that. But the flag, I don't understand why it's there. And it's in many churches across denominations. And, you know, so many churches celebrate July 4th. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm critiquing this. Some, if you're going to use it in a way that's not so... I don't know. It's hard to talk about it. I'm both dual citizen, American and Canadian. But I think if you uphold that higher than the cross, higher than the Christian message, it's a very big problem. And that's why I call it Americanity. In so many ways, Christianity itself here in America isn't so Christian, or the Christian message. Yeah. In the fact that we have said we will go into Iraq in the name of God, we're going to engage in war. And we're engaging in many wars right now as a Christian nation. And so many Christians want it. And I don't understand why. You know, Christ talked about blessed are the peacemakers. You know, the damage, we are killing people and we're destroying the earth. Every missile that lands, it's destroying people's lives and destroying God's creation. There is nothing good in this. But we Americans, it's almost like this empire. We say, oh yes, we have to go in and kill bad people. Everyone is a child of God. And if we can see that, we cannot see it for some reason. We think other people of color are born of a lesser God. Yep. And this is common in America, in the Western world. So I think as Christians, Christ told us to take care of one another, to love one another, welcome the foreigner, embrace, you know, Jesus was healing the lepers. The lepers were those who were sent out because everybody was afraid that, you know, they're going to get leprosy from them. They were sent out of society. Jesus talked with them and cured them. If Jesus did this, we are to do likewise, but we cannot seem to. The message found here in America, the Christian message, it's so foreign to me, so foreign from scripture. Yes, it's not Christianity, but Americanity. And I think other people should just recognize it for what it is, because we go into war in the name of God. We kill people. We do all these things in the name of God, which is not so Christian.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is look right now on Twitter, on Christian Twitter, and see the rage against the Palestinian people and the bloodthirst for Palestinian blood to flow in the Middle East. And
it breaks my heart. They just bombed one of the oldest churches in the world. You know what? If that happened here in the U.S., there'll be an uproar if it was like the oldest church here in the U.S. But this is one of the oldest churches in the world. I think it's the third oldest church in the entire world just got bombed. And people sought refuge because, you know, you go into these buildings thinking they're not going to kill you. So it is horrific for me. I have friends there, many Christian Palestinians. You know, they are losing their lives. And, you know, when we think about it, Jesus was born under occupation. The Palestinians have been living under occupation for the last 75 years. It is not what Christ wants. And it is so painful for me. And we go, you know, the Christianity here in America is not the Christian message that Christ has been teaching us. It is really painful for me to see this happening in this world. We just left there 2 days before the strikes happened. And it's just horrific for me to see.
Yeah. Well, let's hope and pray that the American church gets delivered of Americanity and comes to Jesus and becomes
Jesus.
At the end of the book, Dr. Kim, you highlight four Korean concepts that you say can assist us in making the invisible ones visible. They're all beautiful. I really, really enjoyed them all. But the concept of chi as a way of speaking of and thinking about the Spirit of God is, for me, particularly beautiful and intriguing. Can you tell us about the concept of chi and how we might see chi as a new yet ancient way of understanding the Spirit in the vein of the Hebrew Ruach or the Greek pneuma? Tell us about that a little bit.
You know, when I wrote the book, I wrote so many bad things, you know, the negative things about racism and patriarchy. So I really wanted to develop something that was positive, because I didn't want to be a book of ranting of all these things that are happening to Asian Americans. So I developed the theology of visibility. So I used the four concepts to help develop this visibility so that we can make visible of those people who are oppressed. And because you mentioned Palestine, I think in today's worldwide view, I think the Palestinian are made invisible. So I think we really need to work on this theology of visibility, that they are children of God and their issues are important. They are created in the image of God. And I wish every American, every person can see that. And of anyone that is oppressed, that we can see that everyone is created in the image of God. So when we think about chi is an Asian term that means spirit. And when I think about interfaith dialogue, every religion has a concept of spirit. So chi is not a religious term. It just means spirit. And the recognition that the spirit is within our bodies. And I think that's important. You know, I always have students who do Taekwondo or Reiki or Tai Chi. Chi and Tai Chi is the same, spirit, and Reiki means spirit, the energy coming from the hands. I think when we bring that into the Christian concept of pneumatology, of the Holy Spirit, it's a really helpful way to understand the Spirit of God, because I think with Western white male pneumatology, the spirit became more of a philosophical term. It was something out there, nebulous. You don't know what the spirit is. So many, you know, mainline denominations, we don't talk about the spirit. On PCUSA, we don't rarely talk about the spirit because we're so Christocentric. But if we want to talk about the spirit, the presence of God in the world, the spirit that created the world, we recognize that the spirit is also within us. You see, that's a helpful way for me to end this conversation too. Because if we see the image of God, the spirit of God in each other, in you, Reverend Randy, in all your church members, and all the people that listen to your podcast, if we see the spirit of God in the Palestinians and in the Israelis, then how can we hate them? How can we say, let's kill each other? Or in the Ukraine, you know, in other parts of the world, you know, the North Koreans are villainized. But if we can see that we are all brothers and sisters, then we cannot want to engage in war, killing and bombing and shooting. You know, here in the U.S., the gun, you know, so many people die from gunshots. I think if we can see the spirit of God, the chi in each other, and if you want to know more about chi, most of my 22 books are on the spirit, are on chi, so you can get any other book. One of them is called Spirit Life. The other one is called The Homebrew Christianity Guide to the Holy Spirit. Another one is Reimagining Spirit. So majority of my books are all dealing with the spirit. So I hope you will get it, because I do expand on this concept of chi. So I hope all your listeners can get Invisible and then any other book of mine that deals with the spirit chi.
Yeah, I think they will. Since reading this, and this concept of chi as spirit was so beautiful for me, and so it arrested me, and it had me thinking all today about what are we missing in the American church from all the beautiful richness of the cultures around the world, and the different pictures of the divine, and the different beautiful uniqueness about the cultures that are just full in the world. But yet we only have this American lens that we transpose and then we bring to South America or to Asia or to Europe or whatever it might be. What are we lacking in our vision of who God is when we only see God through our lens, through the Americanity lens? So thank you for your work. So Dr. Grace Ji-Sun Kim, the book is Invisible. There's 21 other books that Dr. Ji-Sun Kim has written, and we can't wait for your next one. Can you tell us again what the title is?
Well, the one that's coming out, you know, soon is called Surviving God. That's coming out in March 2024. I co-wrote it with Dr. Susan Shaw, but the one I kept mentioning is called When God Became White, and that's coming out May 7th, 2024. So two books coming out soon. So you can invite me back anytime to discuss any of them or any of my other 21 books.
Dr. Grace Ji-Sun Kim, thank you for staying up late with us, and thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you're enjoying these conversations. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher, where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show in Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode.
If anything we said pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Find us on social media at PPWBpodcast, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com.
See you next time.
Cheers.